Last week's show, I talked about some basic knowledge about comets and asteroids, and specifically Comet Encke, who is the second periodic comet discovered after Halley's, and has just about the shortest orbital period of any known comet, circling the sun every 3.3 years. And in the research that I'm trying to do to learn as much about all this as I can, it's a huge, huge, huge area up there with trying to understand who the whales and dolphins are and what the real global threats to them are. But I've learned that Encke, in the orbit that it's in now, which seems to be relatively stable over astronomical or geological periods of time, its orbit is a small ellipse that never goes outside of the orbit of Jupiter. And apparently it comes no closer than 0.3 astronomical units, which is about a third of the distance from the Earth to the Sun. The average distance from the Earth to the Sun is called an astronomical unit, and it's about 98 million miles. So a third of that would be about, 33 million miles. So Encke never comes closer than 33 million miles to Jupiter, and it only comes about 0.9 astronomical units close to the Sun. So I wanted to correct myself. In my blog posting from last week, I said that Encke is currently immune to the gravitational perturbational effects of Jupiter, which is not entirely true, but it is in its orbit that doesn't bring it any closer than it does, means that it's not subject to having erratic perturbations of its orbit, as happens to a lot of the comets and asteroids with larger orbits that come from further out within the solar system and or beyond the solar system itself. So it is in a relatively stable orbit. But what I want to address first is the whole idea that we are very much not alone. Now, you hear all this talk, people talking about extraterrestrial intelligence and the whole concept of intelligence in general and everything, and it's like humans have been obsessed with, or modern humanity has been obsessed with, our uniqueness and our aloneness. You know, Lauren Isley talked about the long loneliness, which is, you know, it's got to be lonely at the top. We're at the pinnacle of the pyramid of creation, all by ourselves, because the pinnacle of a pyramid is only a tiny little point. There's only room for one. Only one species can be there at the very pinnacle, and everybody else is lower, down below. So I think it's one of the huge delusions of the modern-day distributed mental operating environment that we are obsessed with our aloneness, our singularity, our uniqueness. We think we alone are the species on this planet that has intelligence. We alone are the overlords of the Earth. We alone have the right to do whatever we want, mow down, destruct, murder, eat, consume, rape, pillage, and destroy, and desecrate every other life form and ecosystem on this whole planet, because it's our God-given right to do so. I mean, this, you know, we don't actually go around saying this in so many words, but by their fruits you shall know them. So if an extraterrestrial observer or other beings on this planet happen to be trying to get to know us, not from what we say, but from what we do, that's exactly what they would think. We're like this invasive planetary parasitic blight that's going around. You know, the sum total of our effect is astronomically destructive. So we're not alone. We're not alone mentally, because we're part of a continuum of life consisting of every other species of life, past, present, and future. And we just really have no idea of who all is here with us now. A lot of scientists believe that probably 80% of all of life all of the biomass of biological life forms is microbes that we can't even see. Even if they were in front of our face, we couldn't see them because they're too small, but most of them live down in the earth, down in the soil, in the rocks, in the the hydrothermal vents down on the bottom of the ocean that they're getting ready to deep seabed mine. These are organisms that could easily live on the moons of other planets, or on comets or asteroids. But we're not alone mentally, we're not alone spiritually, we're certainly not alone in the whole sphere of intelligence. In fact, I would say it's just a huge joke or oxymoron that we pride ourselves on our intelligence, but what is it the intelligence to be able to do? To be aware of ourselves? That's another show I'm going to do soon. The tragic flaw of self-awareness. You know, what have we actually accomplished with it? What good has it done us? But that's not for today. But we're not alone physically. You know, we're surrounded by billions of fellow life forms who we don't even recognize their existence or their right to life, much less their quote-unquote intelligence, which in itself is an entirely anthropogenic concept that we invented to describe what we do and then project everybody else onto that. Of course, they're going to come out sucking hot and tit because it's our concept. But what I'm focusing on now is that we're not alone physically. The Earth. You know, we've got the whole concept of space. And it's in our modern mindset, space is essentially empty. And it used to be back in the days of Tesla and Einstein back then, a lot of people believed that the space wasn't empty, that it was filled with a substance or some kind of matter called the ether, which was a medium that could transmit light, because they didn't think it was possible for light to be transmitted through a vacuum, through nothing. And I really think that along the same line of thinking that Rupert Sheldrake has basically laid waste to a lot of fundamental delusions about the whole scientific worldview, for example, that there is no such thing as a constant, like the speed of light. It's not actually a constant, you know, so there's a lot of fundamental flaws. But one of them is that space is a vacuum and that it's empty. It's not. It's got rarefied. It might be relatively empty, but it's not empty. It's filled with all kinds of particles of energy and matter. And I don't think that anywhere you'd go, space could qualify as an absolute vacuum in the sense of, again, these are sort of delusional, asymptotic concepts. The whole concept of zero, absolute zero, the concept of a vacuum. There are limits that can never be reached. But the point I'm trying to make is that the Earth is not alone physically. We've got the other planets that we know about. We've got the Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, which may or may not be a planet depending on who's in power these days. You've got the other sort of smaller planet-like things like Ceres and Pallas. I might be getting some of these names wrong, but they're kind of planetoids or large asteroids that have been known about for a long time, and I'm not sure exactly why something like Pluto was made into a planet where these other bodies weren't. It's all kind of depends on, you know, who the in power group is of the day, who has the power to, for example, get their new word into the dictionary or to get their new body named as a planet or their new fear bogey to be on the mainstream headline news. We have kind of a characteristic, I call it pinnacled isolationism, that's a feature of our distributed mental operating environment that wants us to be alone. Au contraire, we're not physically alone. We're not only does the Earth have a family of planets, we're also very close to our nearest star, which is we call the Sun or Sol. I like the Hopi name Teowa, T-A-I-O-W-A, Teowa. The Sun. We've got a ringside seat on the activities of a giant star. Scientists believe that 99.999% of all the matter in the known universe is a form of matter called plasma. It's kind of fleeting, but it is a form of matter. But it's what a flame is. It's what a star is. It's what incandescence is. So this is the majority of all the matter in the universe is plasma. But speaking of the purely physical dimensions, bodies made of rock and stone and ice and water and minerals and gases and compounds. We've got the planets. We've got the known sort of planetoids that are big enough to sort of keep track of. And then we've got the asteroid belt that's between Mars and Jupiter, which many astronomers believe is the fragments of a planet that broke up a long, long, long time ago. We don't know how that would have happened or what it might have been. There's all kind of myth and legends about other planets in the solar system. Vulcan, Nibiru, Marduk, Planet X. All these. And you've got the, further out, you've got the Oort cloud, that's O-O-R-T, and then the Kuiper belt, that's K-U-I-P-E-R. These are our regions of bodies of material that are where a lot of the comets and asteroids are believed to live and where they come from. And so I'm not sure exactly. I mean, when you start looking at what we believe we know about all this stuff, it's quite complex to try to understand the different physical spatio-temporal locations of these belts, these regions. And if you start looking at what we know about the orbits, the orbital characteristics of any individual body, whether it's a comet or an asteroid or these swarms of objects, whether they're pieces of rock or clouds of dust or various debris from the fragmentation of comets, or, you know, whether it's stuff that originated within the solar system that's part of the same material from which the planets are believed to have coalesced from, or material that's from outside the solar system that's been captured by gravitational forces and kept it in our vicinity. So there's a quote in Bill Bryson's book, A Short History of Nearly Everything, by an astronomer who's describing how many objects there are that are sort of in the vicinity of the Earth. And he said that imagine if you could flick a switch and it would cause every object, say, like, you know, maybe greater than a centimeter in diameter, to light up and be visible in our night sky, that there would probably be billions, if not hundreds of billions, of these objects. So if every one of them lit up, there would be far more luminous dots than there would be stars. And it would be in a 360 degree field of view, because in every direction. So literally we would see how much we aren't alone in the sense of the presence of all these objects. This is just sheer quantitative analysis. So when we look at what these objects are and what they're doing, most of them are just sort of out there doing their own thing. They're moving subject to their own momentum and different kind of gravitational and centrifugal influences that they come into and that are exerted on them by different bodies, planets, stars, all kinds of changes in geometrical relationships and stuff like that. But the most important aspect for us here on Earth is to consider the effects that these bodies have had on us and are having now and will have in the future. And a big part of this has to do with our being impacted by them. We're actually having physical collisions, but yet that's not the only way that these bodies can influence us too. Now, the vast majority will never come in contact with the Earth or our atmosphere. They're just out there, but they could still, you know, be a hazard to anybody trying to fly through space. And another whole dimension is the sort of belt or the sphere of man-made objects that's currently circling the Earth. I don't have an exact figure, but it would probably be in the tens or maybe even hundreds of thousands of all kinds of, like, defunct satellites and discarded waste and rubbish from space activities and clouds of gas and chemicals and broken off parts and all different kind of stuff. And then, you know, periodically this stuff falls to Earth and burns up, but periodically there's also ones just like meteors that are big enough to make it through the atmosphere, and they actually hit the Earth with an impact. I talked before about the astronomers from the Royal Observatory in Edinburgh, Victor Klug and Bill Napier, who are legendary astronomers for formulating the basic paradigm that I'm talking about. And they have a very important paper that I've only been able to read the abstract, but it's called Episodic Bombardment. And what this has to do is, it's a very important concept because that's the cosmic context in which we live. We are episodically bombarded by objects from space, but they're talking about a huge geo-astronomical time frame on tens or maybe even hundreds of millions of years that has to do with the motion of the sun through our arm of the galaxy and how this brings us into different regions that have different amounts of material left over from the creation of the galaxy. And so that we periodically move through regions of varying density during which comets and asteroid material can be captured by the sun and pass through it where we could encounter it, or it might get captured by the sun and become part of the solar system, and then it's moving along with us instead of on the pattern that it was on before. So this is just an incredibly complex scenario involving all these different kind of objects. And it's interesting to think about, but the main, to me, the pragmatic reason for looking at all this is because of the implications that these impacts have had and will continue to have for life on this planet. We're talking about timescales. Klug and Napier's original work is on the timescales of tens of millions of years, but the same kind of idea can be brought down into the human time frame of our ancestors the past few 10 or 20,000 years, generations of human beings that are modern people, even though we know, even in Australia, it's believed that the indigenous Australians, who to me are the very coolest people on this planet of humans, their culture goes back 100 or possibly 200,000 years. So they would have stories about cosmic encounters and impacts and things like that. And that's an area that I've always wanted to learn more about, being able to get inside the head of initiated elders who might have advanced star knowledge like this, not in the namby-pamby modern-day neo-tourism kind of mentality that seems to be overrunning everything, but in a true sense of a tradition of carrying on this knowledge and wisdom without making an attempt to capitalize on it or to Gerberfy it into baby food for people to assimilate in a 30-second soundbite. So we've got basically two ways that comets and asteroids come into our neighborhood. They're either part of the solar system and orbiting all the way from Encke of 3.3 years to long period comets that might have periods of, well, I mean, you know, if they have periods longer than several hundred years, I mean, how could we possibly, there's no way that we could measure this because we haven't even had modern astronomy but for a couple hundred years, maybe 300 or 400. So it's like a period, a comet with a period of 1,000 years, nobody would have seen it before, or they would have, but it would be really hard to recognize that it was the same one. And the comets that come around really not very often have a high probability of changing in some way through losing a lot of their material or fragmenting or collisions with other things. So you might have two comets that come around next time, whereas last time it was one comet. There's all kind of examples of things like this. Comets and asteroids figure heavily in the mythology of people. Then Immanuel Wielikowski wrote at length, especially in his first book, Worlds in Collision, about how the story of all people that he was ever able to study contained stories of similar events, cosmic encounters, catastrophic events happening because of celestial impacts and the aftermath of these things, all kind of doom and gloom scenarios that our ancestors have had to live through. For example, like the flood, the great deluge that's written about in the Bible, and how people have had to live through not just the singular event of an impact, but even the Earth passing through the tail of a comet or emissions from it, matter associated with it, that's lasted for tens or hundreds or even thousands of years. Many, many, many generations of people have had to try to endure and survive, maybe where there was generations without sunlight. I mean, imagine that. You know, and this could have been also from a lot of times whenever there's meteor, asteroid, or cometary impacts, it initiates volcanism, volcanic eruptions, which they themselves have a very dire effect on life with the amount of toxins they spew out, and primarily the smoke darkening the sunlight, which cuts off photosynthesis and makes animals have to breathe ash and live in darkness, and just, you know, it would be horrific. But that's one of Wielikowski's primary hypotheses, is that our ancestors have lived through that, not once, but many, 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 many times, so that we've become psychically traumatized to the degree that, as a whole, even though the memories of all this stuff is buried and stored in our collective consciousness, we refuse to deal with it. We refuse to acknowledge all this is there. And because of that, this influence has festered over probably thousands of generations and helped us mutate into what we've become now. The Homo sapien macrovirus, who is obsessed with using our most advanced technology, our most advanced I-word, intelligence, to create weapons of mass destruction aimed at ourselves and our own planet and our fellow life forms. So, in another way, this is also what Wielikowski observed, that we're obsessed with trying to emulate the gods. We're trying to outdo the gods who kicked us in the ass and brought us to our knees so many times. We're trying to prove that we can be just as destructive, or we can outdo their destructiveness by creating our own weapons of mass destruction. That first we had the gunpowder and bombs and missiles, and then we had the atomic bomb with big, big, bing, wham, whammy, boom. And then now, even beyond that, with geophysical warfare and electromagnetic ionospheric heaters, we can manipulate the weather, storms, manipulate tornadoes, generate earthquakes, and weather, and wind, and lightning, and just all the stuff. We're trying to emulate the gods, and the gods are known for their favorite thing to do, which also Wielikowski called theomachy. That's theomachy, war of the gods. In Hobart, 3 years ago, I met some Tibetan monks called the Gyoto monks. They're the ones that do the chanting, and they were creating a sand painting there in the center in Hobart down by the wharf, and I got to know them, painted some rocks for them, and I asked one of the guys if he could tell me the Tibetan word for comet, and he wrote it down, how to pronounce it, and he also wrote a bad omen. So, at least in the Tibetan mythology, a comet is a bad omen. So I never looked at comets and thought a bad omen, but I can see that in a lot of cultures, that is what they represent. And I think that it ties back into these ancient memories of that may not even be from that long ago. Like some people are saying that they think that things that like the environmental changes like climate disruption that seemed to happen relatively suddenly about 11 or 12,000 years ago, the inception of a little ice age, might have had to do with a comet or asteroid impact. And so, again, a lot of cultures do look at comets as something to be feared or harbingers of doom because of all the stuff that has happened in the past. Also, I learned that the Native American war bonnet that you see the chiefs wear with the big circle of feathers and the big tail of the feathers hanging down all the way to the ground, that that's actually based on a comet. And another thing that you come across in reading Klub and Napier, as I'm doing right now, is that maybe even a few hundred years ago, the sky was actually quite different. Like, they're saying that it's possible that Comet Encke, for example, was a lot brighter, and that it could be seen shuttling around within the zodiac, just like the planets, only moving a lot faster. But it was that bright. It was as bright as Jupiter, Venus, or Saturn, but was shuttling around, and sometimes it would have a tail, and sometimes it wouldn't. And that also, many comets over throughout history have had different visual properties that have been related to what the Electric Universe people talk about as plasma discharge patterns. And there's a picture in their book of some ancient Chinese comet symbols. And it's really freaky if these symbols actually represent what people actually saw. It's absolutely nothing like the simple tails that we see associated with comets today, because a lot of it could actually have to do with the electromagnetic properties of plasma. Like, we tend to think of comets in the mainstream paradigm that it's the ice is melting from the energy of the sun and then it's blowing off. But that's really not the case. It's called outgassing. Anyway, the point is, comets are not a thing of the past. There's millions of them out there right now, and we don't really know nearly as much as some astronomical authorities would like us to believe. And the work of these Czechoslovakian astronomers that came out 2 or 3 years ago, they're saying that they believe there's a lot more large size objects within the Encke stream than we're aware of, that they're being hidden behind clouds of dust and debris. But the important thing, the reason I'm recording these shows now, the second show, we're still within depends on who you talk to. We're definitely within the June, July Encke window right now. And some people are saying that the primary time for that we're crossing this swarm of objects is not even doesn't even start until today, and then it's for the next few days, and then again another couple of weeks later in July. There's a really interesting graphic that I'm attaching, embedding in this the email associated with this show, that shows how it's believed that the Earth crosses one of the Encke swarms. But it's something to be aware of, because it's only a matter of time till another significant level impact or a catastrophic event happens again, whether it's at the level of Tunguska or even greater, which is not impossible. It's been a really long time since we've had something like that, or so it seems. I mean, our memory doesn't go back that far. But comets are believed to be associated with possibly bringing water to the Earth, also bringing substances like, for example, hydrocarbons. And even Velikovsky talks about the story of manna, the sort of food that appeared on the ground that came from heaven for the Hebrew nomads. He's saying that that could have possibly been the product of a comet. There, it's also possible that comets and asteroids have brought microbes, viruses, spores, diseases, or possibly the origin of life itself came to the Earth on a comet or comets. We just don't really know, but we do know we are not alone in this universe. I've talked about the Hopi prophecy a lot on this show and how in 1986 I went to Big Mountain in Arizona and got to meet Thomas Banyakya, who was the Hopi elder that was the first of the Hopis to be instructed to take their prophecy and their story out to the world. And I was learning about the global nuclear scenario and standing on the ground where some of the uranium for the first atomic bomb was mined, learning about the Hopi prophecy and their admonition that we were never meant to do any mining. Their prophecy said if we dig precious things from the land, we will invite disaster. And then during that week I was up there, when we came down to Flagstaff, I saw that the Chernobyl radioactive core meltdown happened in the Ukraine while I was up there learning about all this. And Thomas Banyakya's words have been echoing in my mind ever since, when he said that the Hopi prophecy says that periodically Mother Earth and the Great Spirit have to cleanse the Earth of that which is out of balance of life, that we're living in the fourth world, because three times before, human civilization has become so big and destructive, very much like where we are right now, and this was 30 years ago, that they have to take steps that for the sake of all of life, they have to get rid of a lot of what's here because it's become so diseased and off of the true path of the Great Spirit. And he said there's no way that we can prevent or avert the day of purification, but that through all our good works and living in tune with life and living in love on a path with heart and trying to live on the true path of the Great Spirit and to walk our talk and to honor and love our fellow beings and Mother Earth, that we might lessen the severity of the purification. So that's what we can hope to do. We can't possibly hope to save anything about ourselves. Not, I don't even think we deserve to be saved as a whole. We've gone so far off the rail and we've been warned so many times. We've just spurned it. We've put our pedal to the metal with military-industrial desecration and destruction. And this is just going on more and more now. And I find myself quite often just feeling absolutely sickened by what I see my fellow man engaging in, that's just absolutely wantonly destructive and so maliciously ignorant. And it's like a necropolis way of, I can't even call it a way of living, that most people seem to be obsessed with and engaged in, and stuff that people don't even notice. And that's why I wrote the poem asking the comet to please come quick, because Mother Earth is very sick and she does need to be cleansed of us somehow. Because not that we're innately bad by our true nature, but we do not have the ability to correct our course. Now, as every day goes by, it's all getting more and more of a mind of its own. So, you know, I can devote a whole show to just looking at examining the possible mechanisms for why we periodically have what the Hopis call koyaanisqatsi, or life out of balance, which more than any other singular concept from any culture that I'm aware of, it describes what seems to be going on the Earth right now. Man, life out of balance, or crazy life. So, you know, it could be that it's a cyclical perspective related to astronomical motion of the sun and the solar system within different realms of influence, the arms of the galaxy, and getting close proximity to different kind of energy sources. You've got this kind of relates with the Hindu idea of the yugas, which are kind of seasons of a galactic year. We don't really have specific numbers to go with them, but the yugas are probably on the order of hundreds of thousands or millions of years each. And these different kind of influences on the Earth could be cyclical and they could be random, and it's probably a combination of both. In the same way that Velikovsky talks about the Darwinian idea of uniformitarianism, you know, sort of like that life on Earth has been sort of just going along pretty much the same with the same influences for billions of years. But Velikovsky emphasizes the importance of what he calls cataclysmic evolution, which is when this uniformitarianism is punctuated by celestially originating catastrophic events that exert tremendous influences on life on the planet. And these events also are responsible for the true climatological disruptions that we've had by spewing out massive amounts of debris into the atmosphere and initiating volcanic reactions. And so for those two factors alone would drive a stake into the heart of any sort of normal weather events that were happening. And that something like that would happen overnight. So, you know, unlike the whole myth of anthropogenic climate change based on carbon dioxide, that kind of thing, climate change happening relatively instantaneously due to celestial impacts, that's real in the history of the Earth. But, you know, within the context of this kind of thing happening, we've also got, since before the Earth even existed, we've had other stars. We've had the center of the galaxy that's beaming out all kinds of energies. Occasionally, a burst of energy might come out, like Dr. Paul LaViolette talks about, that these have massive influences on all the bodies in the whole galaxy. Galactic core bursts, you've got supernovas and novas that just kind of go off randomly here and there, and depending on how far away we are, how much of an influence that could be. So this is all and you've got the constant emissions from the sun, not just the optical infrared and ultraviolet, but all kind of radiation and things we don't even understand, that life here has evolved only because of all these energies and stuff. So occasionally there might be, we've been able to grow and adapt, and our whole genetic library, our gift of our genome that Rachel Carson describes so eloquently, is a beautiful, beautiful gift, but it's been designed for us to live within the context of all these emanations and energies. But occasionally the catastrophic impact might wipe out a lot of us, a lot of life, and then she grows new life forms and starts all the way over again. So for example, maybe like the Cambrian explosion. So we have to honor these cometary impacts as being the progenitors of a lot of new life. And that's exactly what will happen after the next major planetary catastrophe happens, that I'll say, hopefully, is going to take out man the wise, because I don't see any other way that Mother Earth is going to be able to remove the cause of her disease other than through something like that's going to be able to perform sort of geological cosmetic surgery on her surface and bury all our nuclear waste way down under tectonic plates and just get rid of all the tumorous infrastructure that we continue to create. We're transforming everything that's alive into stuff that's not alive. But now we get to the really interesting part. Are these collisions, do we look at them purely randomly? Or do we attribute a meaning to them? And of course, it's like, you know, the tree falling in the forest. If nobody was there to hear it, did it make a sound? Well, if there was nobody here to experience the planetary catastrophe, was it a catastrophe? And here again is where it gets much more complex, because you go like, well, does the experience and the memory and the feelings of other life forms matter? And to me, they all matter more than us, because no other life form has dared to have the arrogance or audacity to proclaim that they're the sole bearers of intelligence on this planet. And no other life form has waged war against everybody else, like we're obviously doing right now. But I believe that the whales and dolphins, just for example, but they've had brains and nervous systems more advanced than ours for probably tens of millions of years, and they would have seen catastrophic events like this numerous times, and I talked in my show last week about how these pod of dolphins that I'd been swimming with here telepathically transmitted an image into my mind that was what a comet or asteroid might look like if it was coming straight toward us, and that this was collectively stored in their memory, and that they were telling me two things: that A, their ancestors witnessed this and lived to tell, and B, that something else like this is getting ready to happen again soon. And I think that they really have not only astronomical knowledge, but astronomical sensitivity and awareness, and the ability to perceive processes in the whole heliocosm that we don't even have any idea exists. They're able to sense it and feel it because of their connection with water, with the contiguous body of Mother Ocean, which is really like one giant water molecule, one giant liquid crystal that's able to resonate with and gain information from anything that's happening in the solar system or maybe even beyond, and to be connected with the origins of water-based life herself. I think the whales and dolphins have all kinds of knowledge and wisdom in this kind of area, but we're just not ready for it yet. I'm trying to transduce as much of this as I can, but I keep getting these messages of urgency telling me to talk about this kind of stuff because it's getting ready to happen again soon. So we can look at all these impacts as being random events, but that's what science would say. But the Dreamtime ancestors and the mythological stories of ancient people talked about it in a different way. They said, and there's all kind of stories of this throughout the mythology of all kind of cultures, that humanity has been punished by the gods. And we always thought that was just some storybook stuff, but it could really make a lot of sense, especially if you look at it as a metaphor for what the gods actually are. The gods could be the planets and the comets and the asteroids and the stars and the forces of nature that we depersonalize into force fields and mathematical abstract entities. But who's to say that they aren't intelligences, and that there isn't a guiding great spirit that's trying to be the protector of life, and who actually created us, and who is actually now not happy with us because of how far off the rail we've gone, how we refuse to live on the true path that we were created to be part of. So it makes a lot of sense to me that we do live in a teleologically aware universe, that if Mother Earth needs to be cleansed of all that's out of balance of life, and if the only way for that to happen is for a comet or asteroid to come and take out military-industrial civilization, I think that needs to happen as soon as possible for the sake of all the life forms that are already suffering because of what we're doing. And we're walking around glorifying ourselves, patting ourselves on the back, thinking that we're environmental activists, thinking that we're saving the whales, and just indulging in all this ludicrous and gratuitous misbelief and misplaced activity, mainly designed to gratify our own obsessions and to elevate ourselves even more, to hone down the fine point of the pinnacle on which we perch ourselves, our species' self-aggrandizement. Carl Jung created a very interesting concept called synchronicity, and his essay was called Synchronicity, an A-causal connecting principle. So what he was saying is that a synchronicity is the perception of two or more events together in time that probably don't have any actual causal relationship other than the fact that we perceived them together in time. That's what a synchronicity is, but our whole way of fabricating reality is very much based on that. We see things at the same time, and they're, of course, we causally relate them in our mind, even though that may really not be the case. So, if some of us think that the Earth needs to be cleansed of the Homo sapien macrovirus, and that the best way for that to happen is from a comet or asteroid impact. And if that happens anytime soon, is that random or is it teleological? Is it just a product of the comet's orbit being perturbed or captured by the gravity of the Earth and drawn down? Or is it Mother Earth being cared for and humanity being punished, if you want to look at it that way, by we're just being taken out? It's like because we've become a disease. The only way for Mother Earth to heal from the human disease is to get rid of the source of the disease, which is not humanity by our very nature. If we were still living like true indigenous people, everybody would be laughing, but we're not. There's not really even hardly any truly indigenous people left anywhere when it really comes down to it. So this is the big question of the day. But either way, regardless of how or why it happens, I think that a planetary cleansing level event does need to happen for the sake of all of life, so that she can come back anew and bring forth the new dreaming, the new creation that I was honored when Barbara Randall, who was the widow of Uncle Bob Randall, one of the custodians of Uluru, one of the most powerful places in Australia and on Mother Earth, she told me that I was painting and bringing in the new dreaming, which was a very, very, very high compliment. Anyway, look to the skies, this inky window, and comet, comet, please come quick. Mother Earth is very sick. Comet, comet, please come now to cleanse the earth of us somehow. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson signing off for On the Brink Radio. Stay tuned for upcoming shows, interviews with Terry, Mr. Limpet Lily, the marine biologist from Kauai, guitarist Eric Wallow from Norway, and much, much more. Kia Manuia and good day.
Truth on the Tracks. You can catch every Monday night and Friday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time here on UCY.tv.